Hey, pilgrims, do you like coffee? If you do, then you probably know that the secret to making the best coffee is starting with freshly roasted beans. But there's no way to know when the coffee you get at the grocery store or your local cafe was roasted. That's outrageous! Which is why Sparkplug has sauntered in, wearing their boots and spurs, to save us from mediocre coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But best of all, Sparkplug delivers this amazing coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. They even offer autopilot set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So, plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to the Next 100 Project, the podcast that drops on Mondays and does deep dives into classic films. Our deep dives are often rife with spoilers, and this one will be also. I'm the man who won't speak like Jimmy Stewart too often. And who's never shot anyone, Ryan Ellis. And with me is the gun-loving wife who's undoubtedly shot many, Bev.
That's me.
She's very violent. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Which of the many stars in Liberty Valance, including John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart, Vera Miles, Lee Marvin, John Carradine, and Edmund O'Brien, acted in the most feature films?
I totally thought it was going to be John Wayne because he notoriously starred in more films than anybody else.
Trick question.
But it's John Carradine by a country mile. Mm-hmm. And he claims to have starred in over 450 films, but he's only credited in 225, which still beats John Wayne by a lot, who was only in 142 movies.
Well, the numbers I have, according to the IMDb, are 221 for John Carradine, 167 for the Duke, 79 for James Stewart, 70 for Edmund O'Brien, 56 for Lee Marvin, but only 42 for Vera Miles. So yes, Carradine was the nice trick question there. One of the many Johns in this film. John Carradine, John Wayne, and of course the director, John Ford. All right then, the Next 100 Project's 61st title, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, was not nominated for the 1998 or 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. Paramount Pictures released the flick in April 1962, so we air this podcast just a few weeks past the movie's 55th anniversary. It had a sizable budget, but it still turned a hell of a profit. Okay, Bev, this 55-year-old movie needs explaining, so give him the skinny.
Jimmy Stewart is Ransom Stoddard, a young Eastern lawyer who goes west to find his fortune and is shocked, to discover that violence and grandstanding are the law of the land in Shinbone, USA, instead of reason and civility. John Wayne's Tom Donovan tries to teach Rance how to stand up to local bully Liberty Valance, played by Lee Marvin, while Rance teaches Tom's crush Hallie, played by Vera Miles, how to read and write. Somebody gets shot. I won't say who. If I may, in a nutshell, Mr. Smith goes to Shinbone.
Nicely done. I will add this part. Mr. Smith is a big fat liar. Becoming a successful politician under false pretenses.
Mm-hmm.
The spoiler of this film is that he is not the man who shot Liberty Valance. In fact, two characters at the beginning of the story, the title characters, in fact, are both dead. John Wayne and Lee Marvin. The man is John Wayne, and Liberty Valance, of course, is dead long before the story's over. All right then, so some numbers. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, 93% of them liked this film, 39 fresh, only 3 rotten, and 92% of audiences, but it was unappreciated at the time. It's one of those pictures that's gained in esteem as the years have gone on. It was 17th at the 1962 U.S. box office. Lawrence of Arabia, which we covered, of course, was 1962's big hit, and also the Oscar winner of that year, Best Picture, Best Director, and so on. All right, Bev, this long flashback movie, just like A League of Their Own, where it starts with one little story at the very beginning. Let me tell you my story. And then it's the whole movie from before and then back up to the older characters, just like A League of Their Own.
That's where the parallels end.
Well, what'd you think of this one then?
I wish that the pacing had been snappier and more succinct. I think that formatting it in the bookended flashbacks was a mistake that took all the dramatic tension out of the violence. And it's a shame because I believe that if the movie had solved those problems, then it would be a masterpiece. The themes are so beautifully wrought, and John Wayne just breaks your heart. So as a thought-provoking study in moral ambiguity and change, it's tremendously successful. But I think as an entertaining, engaging bit of storytelling, it's simply good, but not great.
That's fair. I like the movie more than you, I think. I love westerns, but a lot of them are macho crap. Although not Shane, one of our favorites, and not this. John Wayne has all these layers he wasn't used to having, and in the end, he is the noble hero who sacrifices for the greater good.
And it's kind of an indictment of machismo as a way of running things. But at the same time, there's the heartbreak and the tragedy. Tom is definitely a macho character, and he definitely does the right thing. He's definitely a hero, but he's punished for his inability to carry on with civility the way that Rance can.
Because the world's moving on without him, just like it does in Shane. The cattleman idea, that's in this movie too. Both of the films have this, where the cattleman thing is going by the wayside, where you're just out there in the middle of nowhere and do whatever you want with your cattle and make all that kind of money. No, it's about people are going to put down settlements and have law and order. Yeah. And then, of course, politics. It's interesting that this movie is so political for a Western, but then again, it was made by a bunch of Republicans. Ford, Wayne, and Stewart were all Republicans. Not that that was a bad word back then. A lot of our listeners might think it's not a bad word now.
Yeah, the film portrays that tipping point of going between the wildness of the untamed West and civilization. You've got all the elements of government. You have free press, you have elections, and you have education. All those things serve to civilize a place. And the fact is that while, of course, a lot of people were drawn by the wildness of the untamed West, and they fancied that they would be either Liberty Valance or Tom Donovan, because they resent the trappings of government, like taxes and rules and protection of the weak. But no place stays wild forever, and most people thrive in civilization. All those homesteaders, you know, they prefer the safety and predictability and just the sheer civility of civilization.
There's a lot of themes in this film that we've seen in a lot of other movies too, but it's maybe done better in this than most Westerns or most movies, period. The useless cops, or cop in this case, Andy Devine, who's the marshal, he's useless as a young man, he's even more so as an older man. The lying politicians, and a lot of them are lying, but especially Rance Stoddard. He knows the truth. He knows when he's a young guy, but he goes on with it. Well, young guy, I love that too. Jimmy Stewart and John Wayne are both in their 50s when this movie was made, and they're supposed to be playing characters who are in about their 20s.
Yeah, it's definitely miscasting. But it's smart casting because, you know, the movie is about the death of the West, and it was about the death of the Western. So you cast these actors of Western who are also aging and changing and kind of have to hang up their hats as well. And so I think he was trying to draw the themes by casting these extremely famous personalities.
John Wayne did a lot of Westerns in his career, and I don't think he did too many more after this one. Well, then again, he did at least one or two more. Maybe he did more than I'm thinking.
Well, if some of his most famous parts, like True Grit and The Shootist.
Right, okay, right. So he did more than I thought he did. I also did Rio Lobo. But Jimmy Stewart had done a bunch of Westerns in the 50s, and people were surprised he could be this darker character. And, of course, we saw him so much darker than we ever thought he could be in things like Vertigo, even Rear Window with Hitchcock. But before that, when he did Westerns for Anthony Mann, like Winchester 73, it was an interesting take having Jimmy Stewart play not a bad guy, but a darker character than he ever had before. And then he did a bunch of Westerns in the 50s after that, too, a genre he'd rarely done before that. So you're right, and you get these two guys who are known for Westerns, more so John Wayne, and then have it be that the death of the Western is going on here, along with these characters who effectively are dying. John Wayne's character does die. Rarely in movies did he die, but he's dead when the story even gets going.
Although it's a flashback. I mean, he died of old age, right? He died of natural causes. He wins in the violence that takes place in the movie and presumably carries on with his life. But in a way, he dies because he doesn't get what he wants. He doesn't get his own
homestead. Of a broken heart.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's true. He loses in many ways.
And the James Stewart character does move on to be a successful politician and marry Hallie and have what looks to be a great life. But when he goes back to Shinbone to tell his story, it does seem like a part of him died in that way, where he was back in that town where he was trying to do the right thing and knows that in the end he didn't do anything wrong, but also didn't do the right thing because he accepted the lie.
So I totally buy Jimmy Stewart playing a conflicted character like this who's ultimately a good person that makes some difficult decisions, but I cannot imagine him ever playing straight a villain like you described. It would be like watching Tom Hanks play a villain. There's some actors I simply can't buy it.
The one time Hanks played what they said was going to be a villain was in Road to Perdition, and even then he's just the best of the bad guys.
Yeah.
He's a bad guy by normal human standards. He's stealing from people and he's killed people in that storyline, but he is the wronged person. Paul Newman and he have this interesting relationship, but he's not the bad guy in the film. Daniel kind of Craig is the bad guy.
Yeah, he's kind of like an honorable killer, and he's a good dad as well, so you root for him.
And then Stewart in Vertigo, it's a lot more of a Shades of Grey kind of deal, just like Rear Window, like I said, with the Hitchcock pictures. Well, the town of Shinbung was shot on stages, so no shooting in John Ford's favorite place, Monument Valley. That was an interesting touch, and it's been spun maybe by John Ford since that he wanted to try something different by having it be stages rather than have the crutch of Monument Valley. But then it was also supposed to be a budget thing, just like they shot in black and white. In 1962, that wasn't so common anymore. The reason why was to hide the age of the actors. The makeup can make them look at least more reasonably aged, although Stewart especially, because he's supposed to be a young lawyer. Donovan's age doesn't matter. He could have been a 50-plus-year-old man in the beginning of the story. That doesn't really make a difference, but Stewart is supposed to be at least youngish.
Yeah. He's supposed to be starting his life, and he just looks like an old man. You have to cast an actor who can play old and play young because he ages 30 years over the course of the movie. But John Wayne, there's no reason to cast somebody that age. You're in your 50s and you haven't married yet. I don't really feel bad that you didn't get Hallie, because you waited this long to pick a girl.
You think the worst casting of the two of them is John Wayne?
Okay, listen, I love him in this movie, and I think he's perfect. I wouldn't change the casting, not a little bit. I think he makes the film. He's my favorite thing about it. But it's absurd that he's playing a young man. They could have written the character older. They could have cast someone older than Vera Miles to play the object of his affection.
But I'm saying that he doesn't have to be any certain age, but the Jimmy Stewart character does as a young wannabe lawyer. So it's more absurd that Stewart is the one who is...
Okay, but they have to get him to play an older man at the beginning of the film, so you can see why they would have to find a happy medium.
Okay, well, this doesn't have to be dwelled on too long, because they went with the big-name stars because they wanted to go with big-name stars. And also, John Ford, again, uses his stock company of people like John Carradine, like John Quaylen, and Woody Strode, and Vera Miles, and The Searchers. So that was part of the reason why all these actors in this movie, because they're John Ford people.
But he didn't want John Wayne to play Tom Donovan, and apparently he made it really clear on set, and they had this really antagonistic relationship.
They always did, though.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
He would, like, give him a hard time about the fact that he never fought in World War II. Well, he made propaganda films, but Jimmy Stewart actually fought. He flew a bombardier.
That's the irony of the two characters in this film. Between Duke and Jimmy. In reality, Duke was a chicken hawk, and Jimmy was the war hero. James Stewart is one of the great war heroes in the history of non-typical war people. Mm-hmm. You talk about baseball players who went over there like Ted Williams or Willie Mays and served in the war, and then actors like James Stewart and other people that went over there. Stewart was a well-decorated man, and his son served in Vietnam. John Wayne and his progeny, none of that. Mm-hmm. And yet, John Wayne was one of the big red hunters in Hollywood during the communism era, and also never served a day over there, despite making all kinds of war films and westerns, and acting like, I'm the big man. Now, we've talked about that before in some of our previous podcasts, in westerns that you liked, by the way, Stagecoach and The Searchers, Wayne and Ford, that combination that worked together so many times. But Ford was a war veteran and also shot stuff over there, as did Frank Capra, John Huston. I think even George Stevens, a lot of the classic directors of the 40s, did war photography and were put into danger. John Wayne never did any of that stuff. So yes, that's the irony of his bravado about war. Stand up for America, because he never really did in reality, just supposedly at home. Okay, but as for him doing the right thing by using the shotgun to take out Liberty Valance, did you see that coming? Because you never saw the movie before this viewing.
You know, I honestly didn't. The tension and the violence is kind of removed because you know exactly which characters are going to live and that Liberty Valance is going to die. But,
Yeah, spoiler alert title.
I wonder if Liberty's going to be okay. He's not. So
the man who wounded Liberty Valance is not the movie.
No. I kind of figured that Rance got a lucky shot off or something, or that maybe the theme of the movie would now be Rance coming to terms with committing an act of violence and taking someone's life because he's so adamantly against it for most of the film. But it goes a different direction that I'm not expecting. It genuinely did surprise me. What the film does right and the reason that it's so worth watching and absolutely deserves its status as a classic is the moral ambiguity. There's so much density to the decisions the characters make and the consequences that they face. That turn of events, I mean, that's why it's called The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. What does it mean that the manly character, that the old guard, the one who is right for the old world and did everything right to belong, to fit in, to succeed in the old West, and is now becoming obsolete, saves the person who's, for all intents and purposes, replacing him?
Ironically, you talk about war parallels, we just said that a minute ago. People that came back from war, we saw that in The Best Years of Our Lives, of course, even though I criticized the Rambo series, the first Rambo movie does this very well. They don't have a place in society when they've come back from that kind of thing. Sometimes they do, but generally they have a hard time fitting back in when they've gone over to kill people for a living. And now Tom Donovan, not in a war setting, has been a war hero in effect, and he has killed somebody, but he can't fit into this new society. And in that same night, he's suicidal. He burns his place down. You never saw John Wayne do that, I don't think, ever before. Certainly not very often before. And in that moment of shooting Liberty Valance, he sets the fate of the three main characters, himself and Rance and Hallie. Because Hallie seems to choose Rance that night, Rance has now been made the hero by all these guys, and Donovan is just the man left out because nobody but he and Rance know the truth.
And if he told the truth, he could be charged and convicted with murder.
Leaving them with no proper politician in that area, which they need, obviously.
It's also pretty clear that if Law and Order is coming, then what he did was a very serious crime and he should go to prison for killing Liberty Valance. It's brought up by Liberty's two little cronies.
Wait, hang on a second. Everyone thinks he did kill him, but it's a fair fight, so there's no reason why you have to go to jail.
Donovan is never going to tell the truth because he should go to jail for doing what he did. That's not a fair fight, shooting from the sidelines. So if Rance was ever honest and said, I was the one who shot him, he could be condemning Tom to a life in prison, too.
Okay, right, yeah, that's true. Well, you've got this contrast between those two characters. Donovan is one of Duke's nobler characters and seeing the bigger picture and all that. But then Rance is emasculated by wearing an apron in so much of the film and washing dishes. And Jimmy Stewart never wears a hat in this movie, if you notice. Typically, Western heroes wear hats. But that was a very deliberate choice by John Ford. Rance is also called Dude, and as the stranger in The Big Lebowski once said, that's a name no one from the West would self-apply. It's very clearly an insult to call somebody Dude so often, but Lee Marvin, who's great in this movie, by the way, often calls him the Dude.
I think it means somebody from the East coming to the West is a Dude.
Yeah, we've made it to be a nice term of affection now, but it was definitely an insult in the Old West.
Yeah, they call them Dude Ranches because it's for tourists. The Dude is the tourist.
And an uppity kind of person is another thing it was insinuating, that you're better than me, you think you're better than
me. Yeah, and he literally shows up with carpet bags full of law books. He doesn't belong there, but he also seems to hold his head up high. Like, you talk about how emasculated he is, and he absolutely is. The movie's crystal clear about the role machismo plays in the Lawless West and the fact that Rance has none. He wants to solve all his problems with rule and order, essentially talking, practicing the law. He wears an apron. They specifically say, no man waits tables, and yet he waits tables. He comes out, they call him the waitress, trip him, and he never wants to resort to violence. Until the end, of course, when he would have gotten killed protecting his ideals of law and order, too. Yeah.
He's a sitting duck if Donovan didn't do what he did.
Yeah, he's not ashamed of his, for lack of a better word, effeminate side. The fact that he's not macho, that gives him no shame. And he wins in the end. There is a feminization of the Old West.
Well, even
machismo
during,
isn't currency anymore.
And even during the story, he is actually feminizing. It's really not even the word I want to use here, but he's making the town of Shinbone better by being a teacher of all these people, this diverse group of people. Look at his class. There's young, there's old, white, black, Hispanic. Pompey's a part of it. We haven't talked about Woody Strode, the unsung hero of the whole movie and an unsung hero in a lot of films. So he was in Spartacus as an unsung hero in that too. He's the one that sacrifices himself for Spartacus, because of course Spartacus would have died had the Woody Strode character not been willing to sacrifice himself. And here he's just an assistant to Donovan, but better than that. A character is very similar in The Searchers, the previous Ford and Wayne movie that we covered a long time ago on the Top 100 Project. And that guy was mentally retarded, I think is what the movie's implying. But this guy is an equal to Donovan, except he's black, so he's not an equal. And they even have a scene where he's not allowed to drink in the bar, but Donovan says, let him have a drink. And that's a scene we saw in Legends of the Fall quite nicely, too, where it's an Indian who can't drink. Yeah. But Brad Pitt insists, give him a drink!
They don't make race an issue in that they don't really deal with it in the film, but they also point it out. John Ford wants you to see it and just know that racism existed in the town and understand. Also understand, like you said, that Pompey's is equal. And in many ways, the better guy. He's always doing the right thing. He's like, I don't want to have a drink because there's work to do. He saves Tom from the fire and is a right honorable guy. I was about to call him a dude and then I would stop myself because...
Well, in our parlance, it's okay.
Yeah,
their parlance, it's not okay.
I call people dude all the time.
Well, the man who calls Rance Stoddard a dude, of course, is Liberty Valance. That's a great name, too, especially for a real great bad guy, Lee Marvin.
What a great name that his name is Liberty, because it's the freedom. He is free, but that's what freedom gets you, is bullies like that.
And he gets aces and eights in the poker hand before he goes out to face Rance, which
the dead
in
man's
Western,
hand.
Yeah, in Western parlance is dead man's hand, which means he's about to die. That was one of those cliches that was not in every single Western, but a lot of them, kind of like the Wilhelm scream is in so many movies now. I can't do the Wilhelm scream, but people probably know that from the Star Wars movies. That's where it became quite famous. But that actually is from a Western, the Wilhelm scream.
In case anybody doesn't know why the dead man's hand is the dead man's hand, it's the cards that Billy the Kid had.
Wild Bill Hickok, I believe.
Wild Bill Hickok had when he was shot dead while playing poker.
And speaking of being shot dead, the big confrontation. It should have been easy to identify a rifle bullet versus one from a handgun. Maybe they didn't do an autopsy because they didn't want to know the truth.
Yeah, and maybe because both the sheriff and the doctor were drunks who didn't ever want to do their jobs, especially the sheriff.
And everyone saw what looks to be a simple one-on-one confrontation. Donovan timed it perfectly. Lucky for him, he did. So why would you possibly investigate that? There's no reason to.
You say nobody wanted an investigation, but Liberty's two little buddies did want to go and hang Rance. They wanted justice for their friend, but it was hopeless because the people ran up against them. Mm-hmm. I can see how the movie could have made it seem as if there was a possibility that his one less giggly buddy could have replaced him, because he seemed to be serious and violent and scary as well.
That's Lee Van Cleef, who's famous from Westerns, and so is Strether Martin, who's the giggly one. Mm-hmm. Strether Martin's been in so many great Westerns, especially in the 60s, and was also the warden in Cool Hand Luke. What we got here is failure to communicate. Ah. Lee Van Cleef is from the Spaghetti Westerns with Clint Eastwood. And here they're playing lackeys before they became, well, whatever kind of stardom they had, I guess supporting player stars. And very good small roles for both of them, I would say.
So I really like that Lee Van Cleef's character seemed like he could have been a competent villain as well. And that he very possibly, in different time and place, could have replaced Liberty Valance as the villain of the town. But one of the points that the movie is making is that Donovan can shoot Liberty Valance, but he can't stop tyranny in the form of bullies like that. Whereas Rance coming in and creating law and order, actually making the sheriff do their job and actually persecuting criminals, can eliminate that kind of tyranny for all time.
Politics can do that. So here's a question for you. Was Rance qualified to be a politician for an entire state? And the character of the major, played by John Carradine, I think that's his only scene, he points this out. Is this guy qualified? I don't think he is qualified, just because he's the smart one and he's the aspiring lawyer and also this hero that they've created in their own minds.
Well, that's why he needed to have the reputation of being the man who shot Liberty Valance, because he had no experience. Like, you're absolutely right. We root for him because we know he's a good guy and we know that he's smart and he cares and he's full of ideals, but you're absolutely right. He shouldn't have won that election. He shouldn't be in charge of a whole state. Clearly, he makes a good governor and senator and potentially vice president.
Yeah, he had 3 terms as governor, many terms in the Senate, an ambassador, and now he's a vice presidential candidate, at least possibly a candidate for vice president.
Well, he seems to be deciding to pack it in and move back to Shinbone with Hallie, though.
But still, all those credentials and what a great career the guy had. The guy with the brains gets elected to Congress for killing somebody, though, so he is a hypocrite. And, of course, he knows it. And politicians took over in the entire country of America, and self-sacrificing men of action just faded into the woodwork. Although now they want to take their own guns out there and say, I'll defend my own, which, of course, is not legal necessarily and certainly isn't always the right thing to do. The famous line at the end of the film, we've talked about the quotes list so many times for the AFI, but how in the world is, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend? How is that not on the quotes list?
I agree. It's a great line, and it sums up the film so perfectly.
It's also pretty much what American history textbooks have become. Yeah. Legends are more important than facts, including what Americans, well, prior to being Americans, really, when they were just Europeans, did to the Native Americans that were already here.
Yeah. And the journalist understands that what the people of the West want is one thing, and what they need is another. And that's why he's okay with lying to them. Like, they want a tough gunslinger, but what they need is an idealist bureaucrat. So let them believe the legend.
The Batman thing, to a degree. Mm. And the name of the movie is the last line in the movie, which really seems to upset both Rance and Hallie. It's got a bit of a bleak ending. It's almost like the end of Manchurian Candidate, where Frank Sinatra's talking about what happened with Raymond Shaw, and he's going on about, oh, hell. Hell. The movie just goes to black, and that's it. This bleak sort of hopeless ending. And of course, as we've speculated, and other people have too, is Frank Sinatra's character really the Manchurian Candidate? And this is a movie that does the same thing in the same year, 1962.
People must have been ready for some ambiguity in their films. They would rather think about what they're watching than just be mindlessly entertained, because they were both pretty popular. Manchurian Candidate did pretty well, wasn't it?
Not really, but Lawrence of Arabia, which won Best Picture, and as I said already, was the big hit of that year, was, for a movie of its type, pretty ambiguous as well.
Agreed.
Another hero who was a bit of a phony.
And makes you think more than it makes you just root for the story.
And a downer ending. Guy.
Oh, yeah, big time.
Also
oh
a flashback kind of thing, because we see what happened to him in the very beginning, and then we find out how he got to that point. Okay, but back to Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which is a loud movie. There's a lot of yelling by almost every character. Vera Miles is always mad in the first half anyway. Some of the most distinctive voices in movies are in this one. John Wayne with the way he speaks. We all know how that goes. And, of course, Jimmy Stewart. Oh, Jimmy. Andy Devine, I'm not going to try to do Andy Devine, but he plays the useless marshal. And then Lee Marvin, more of a deep voice kind of thing, but that guy was a man of action type in so many movies he did. great voices in this entire film.
And he chewed the hell out of the scenery, too. He is amazing. He's just such an incredible menace.
He's one of the unsung heroes in movies all time, just like Woody Strode is, and one of those guys you don't think about a lot when you talk about the great actors of all time. He wouldn't be in the top 50 necessarily, but for character actors, he certainly is on that shortlist, and he won an Oscar only a few years later for playing a Western hero and villain in Cat Ballou. He plays two characters in that one picture. That was a comedy Western, though, so a little different style than this movie was. By the way, Duke and Jimmy, the big stars in this movie, also co-starred in Duke's final film, The Shootist. John Wayne is top billed between him and Jimmy Stewart. We already covered Stagecoach and The Searchers. This is the first time that the Duke ever called somebody Pilgrim, which he often calls Rance in this movie, and everyone thinks that's his catchphrase for his entire career, but of course it's only from 1962 onward.
After this film, he kept using it.
I don't think he did it all that much, but then people just associated him with that word. Jimmy Stewart did five AFI films. We covered them all, including It's a Wonderful Life and Vertigo. Apart from the fact he's miscast, and I guess you could say John Wayne is too, do you think he's good in the movie?
I don't love him as much as you do. I find him hammy and think he overdoes
I've liked him less since we've done all these movies, especially when we did them chronologically with the Top and Under Project, because you see the evolution of acting in films, and he definitely was the old school, as was John Wayne, but then he does a movie like this where he's pretty layered, and I don't think he even really respected his own performance, John Wayne, in this movie. Jimmy Stewart, though, is pretty hammy, you're right.
I really think John Wayne deserves the credit. Like you said, he's layered. There's so much depth to his performance, and underneath that great bravado that he has and that swagger, there's a pain and there's a loneliness, and you see it, but it's not in your face the way Jimmy Stewart's performance is in your face. And of course, he's one of the most likable men that ever appeared in movies, but when you put him in a film next to actors who are being a little less kabuki about it, maybe it's too much. I find him weird in Westerns in general. I haven't seen a lot of his Westerns, so I find it strange just to see him in a period film.
He was in Western I like a lot a couple years after this called Shenandoah, where he plays the patriarch of a big family. And I thought that was a damn good film. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I liked it quite a bit. But you haven't seen that one. And a Western you really should see with John Wayne, and everyone should see if you haven't already. Maybe at the last few minutes of the film, maybe just cut it off before it gets to the very end. But Red River, where John Wayne plays a guy with a lot of shades of gray, and basically in a lot of that film, is the bad guy. He and Montgomery Clift, two very different kind of actors, too. Clift was just starting his career at that point, and Wayne was, of course, very established. Vera Miles is the love interest in this film. She did The Searchers and, of course, Psycho for us before in the Top Runner Project. She's the angriest chef of all time.
Not enough beans!
And that's more in the beginning, but she's just so mad all the time.
Well, she doesn't have to try very hard to be likable or sweet because she's one of two women in the entire town. So, of course, men are going to pursue her.
The Princess Leia syndrome. Lee Marvin did The Dirty Dozen, and he won the Oscar for Cat Ballou. He was a fierce character actor, and if you haven't seen a lot of his films, you really should, because he was damn good. Edmund O'Brien was in White Heat, and The Wild Bunch is an AFI film we covered, and I bring him up mostly for this reason, because he's fine in the film, but you look at him in White Heat, which is 1949, and look at him in this, but especially in The Wild Bunch, so 20 years between White Heat and Wild Bunch, and that guy aged about 50 years in 20 years. Andy Devine was in Stagecoach. I forgot he was, but I guess he was. He's equal parts hungry and cowardly in this picture. And he's just Andy Devine. That's kind of the way he always was in movies from what I remember of him. John Carradine and John Quaylen were in Grapes of Wrath. And Quaylen was also in Casablanca and The Searchers. Longtime veteran of the business. Obviously did a lot with John Ford. And the last actor I got to mention is Denver Pyle, Uncle Jesse from The Dukes. And also in Bonnie and Clyde, where he has a great role. He's the one that actually turns the tide on the Barrow Gang in that picture. And people kind of forget about the fact that he played anything other than Uncle Jesse. But he's got a small role in Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Directed by John Ford, did Stagecoach, Grapes of Wrath, and The Searchers for us before on the Top Runner Project a long time ago, all of those. He was abusive. He was mean. And the more I read about the guy, the less I like him as a person. But then that's also true about so many directors. He was the opposite of Stanley Kubrick, who we talked about only a few weeks ago in our documentary podcast when we did Making the Shining and that one. He got scenes in a few takes, unlike Kubrick. And he was also an artist who just took a dump on that very concept. He didn't believe he was an artist. I make Westerns. Well, if you look at his movies, he was an artist.
Oh, he's one of the greatest directors in American history. He truly helped create Hollywood.
And he didn't have a big ego about his own abilities, or at least publicly didn't.
If you can be credited with influencing Kurosawa, then I think that you are making art.
And dozens of others. I think we said this before. If they had ever done an AFI Top 50, and they really should have done 100, but they might have done 50 top directors, I bet you they'd vote for him. I bet the list would go Ford, Hitchcock, 1, 2, and then I don't know what the rest of the top 10 would be. Spielberg and Scorsese would have a shot at making the top 10. One of those two probably would. But I bet you anything. Number one would be Ford. Number two would be Hitchcock.
Yeah, they would probably be vying for the 1 and 2 spots for sure.
And when I say he was abusive and mean, you read a lot of stories about him. He could be rough, and he apparently brought John Wayne to tears more than once in
his
career.
Wow.
The writers for the film were James Warner Bella, who was a Ford guy, worked on plenty of his pictures, and Willis Goldbeck, who wrote Freaks long before this. Yes, Freaks in 1932. This was his last movie. He was also one of the producers, along with an uncredited Ford. And they based it on a story by Dorothy Johnson, who had 5 movie credits, and they were all Westerns. The movie is 185:1. We watched the Blu-ray, which looks pretty solid for a movie of this age, and it was black and white, of course, to make the actors look a little less old than they otherwise would have. The cinematographer is William H. Clothier, who shot The Alamo for John Wayne a few years before this, and a lot of other Westerns with The Duke. The editor was Otho Lovering. He cut Stagecoach for Ford a long time before this. The composer was Cyril Mockridge, who was prolific, worked a ton, did Miracle on 34th Street, and also was nominated for Guys and Dolls, a Sinatra and Marlon Brando movie, in the mid-50s. There wasn't that much influence I could find for this movie. Some say this was the last Western, or at least the last great one. I wouldn't agree with that, because, of course, Wild Bunch came later in a different kind of way. Butch Cassidy, Sundance Kid, and I Love Josie Wales, Unforgiven. There are a lot of great Westerns that came after, but it was supposed to almost be the statement. I'm sure Ford didn't feel that way, but that's what critics probably said. I've heard that point made before. And also a top 10 hit for Gene Pitney followed, but it wasn't in the movie soundtrack, so it actually doesn't have anything to do with the movie specifically, but it was based on this movie.
Kind of a song inspired by the movie.
Mm-hmm. You got any influence?
I would never consider myself enough of a Western buff to know whether it influenced or whether it changed Westerns from here on in. I think what was changing Westerns from here on in probably had more to do with the public interest in Westerns, which was never the same after the 50s. People got wise and weren't interested in those stories the same way. So it was probably more of a reflection of the times than an influence on the death of the Western.
And the best Westerns didn't get very big budgets very often. This one had a pretty good sized budget. Didn't usually have big stars, especially multiple big stars. This is a who's who of actors, really. You got John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart, who are huge stars. Vera Miles and Lee Marvin were lesser on that scale, and some other actors as well. But you've got a lot of other people who arguably were headliners, who weren't the headliners in this movie, who were the second or even third billed actors. In the old Westerns, you would have had one star at the most, and everyone else would have been nobodies. It would have been just journeyman actors. That didn't continue on very often in Westerns because they were getting into more movies that were more real. War pictures were probably taking over, I guess, because you had the end of the Korean War wasn't that long before this, and of course Vietnam was just heating up, and the times they were a-changing.
Yeah, art in general was getting more cynical and more serious, and movies were just beginning to follow suit at this point. Bonnie and Clyde hadn't been made yet. They hadn't made that left turn just yet, but this movie certainly is foretelling that change. It's not just giving the audience what it wants, it's making you think and it's making you sad. I think it's a tragic film.
I can see how people could cry watching this movie, especially old types like John Ford sitting there watching this and saying, it's all ending. All right, the awards and list section isn't very long. There was only one nomination for the Oscars, and it was Edith Head's costumes. That name comes up again. Edith Head has done the costumes in so many movies we've covered, but of course she did so many classic movies, so why not? The movie's in the National Film Registry, and it made it in 2007, along with Back to the Future, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Dances with Wolves, Wuthering Heights, and 12 Angry Men, all movies we've covered on the Top 100 Project, or not 100 Project in the case of Back to the Future, but that should have been a Top 100 Project movie.
Yeah.
And it was nominated for several things, including the Top 100 Genres, the Western Category, Top 50 Heroes, Tom Donovan, and the Top 100 Quotes with, "This is the West, sir, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend." And that should have been, if not in the Top 100 Quotes, maybe the Top 10 or 20 Quotes. All right, then, last thoughts on the man who shot Liberty Valance 55 years later.
Well, I have my problems with the film, with the pacing, and it's not a perfect film, but I haven't stopped thinking about it. It was really fun to do my research about it and to just sink my teeth into all the themes of the film. I think when I revisit it, I might enjoy it more because I can get into the more thought-provoking aspects of it once I know what's going to happen and not watch it as passively. Like all John Ford films, there's just so much dense beauty in it.
And you've been a surprising fan of Westerns. There's another one you liked again, right?
Yeah, and all my favorite Westerns are the ones that step back and almost examine Westerns for what they are. And this is a great example of that. And John Wayne, oh my God, he's amazing.
I remember I said this to you a long time ago, but you talk about who's the greatest star in the history of Hollywood, who's the biggest name in Hollywood. It's arguably him, the Babe Ruth of the movie business. I think the movie easily overcomes its flaws, but there's no doubt it is flawed. All in all, I'll take Shane over this, but I dig the man more than most other white hat Westerns.
I'm just dying to watch Shane again. It's made me so hungry to watch
Shane. I did, only a few weeks
ago. That's right, that's right, you did. Watch it without me, I can't believe it.
All right, Alien Covenant will hit theaters on May 19th, So when we return on May 15th, we'll dig our vicious claws into Ridley Scott's Alien. There's another movie that probably should have made the original list, you think about it. We've covered quite a few movies, and how did Alien not make that
list?
Oh
my god, I'm really surprised that it didn't.
Influence alone.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. One of the few movies with a sequel that could genuinely vie for the list as well.
Okay, the coming attraction trivia for Alien. What's the order in which the various characters in Alien die? Meaning, who goes first, then second, and third, and so on.
Alright, so for the answer to that, please tune into next week's podcast. In the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, check out our website, top100project.com. Subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and while you're there, please rate us and review us. It helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we are both on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. And once more, we'd like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Bev, you're awful pretty when you get mad.
Thanks, Pilgrim.
Then again, you're pretty all the time.
Oh, that's the right answer.
I saved Tom Donovan. Mm-hmm.
And cut.
Well, what about me? I thought I was pretty attractive.
Pretty in that apron.
Yeah.